All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is October 19th. Just got done with your fourth test. So you got one more to go. And you're getting them back in lab, and I guess I don't really have anything to say about this last test other than this. All right, so the scores were pretty good. Actually, they were really high for most people. So if you know somebody that still wants to really boost their grade up and you did really good, share how you did that with them. Okay, just share your experience. What did you have to do well on the test? One key is do not procrastinate, right? Okay, so over the weekend, you got to start getting ready for the last test because it's going to happen pretty soon. All right, so let's see. We were talking last time. Are there any questions at all? All right, so Bio 241, I just got to say this again in case I forgot. November 19th, and we're in cardiac output, blood pressure chapter. So we're going to probably not be able to finish that up today, but maybe finish that up today. All right, well, this is the first time I ever clapped before class because of a test. But I didn't think that was a terribly easy test. And a lot of people really excelled at it, so congratulations. Okay. All right, so let's see. Where were we in this chapter? We looked at how heart rate is controlled. All right, so what is the nodal tissue where heart rate is controlled? Yeah, the SA node in particular. And it is autorhythmic, right? And because of those HCN channels and due to potassium channels, the slope of this, what do we call this line right here? Does it have a color? Is it like purple or something? What is that? Red? Oh, nice. Yeah. All right, let me get the pointer options going here. Oh, that's pretty cute. I think I just hung the computer. Ah, good. Oh, it came back. Fantastic. Good. All right. So what do we call this purple area here, red area? That's a pacemaker potential. Oh, that's good. That was on the test. Okay. So that pacemaker potential or the slope of the pacemaker potential can be adjusted by the autonomic nervous system. Right? The SA node is going to have a pacemaker potential one way or the other. The heart does not need innervation to contract, but the autonomic nervous system can adjust the slope of that pacemaker potential to change what? What changes in the heart when the slope of the pacemaker potential changes? Heart rate. And how do you measure heart rate? If you're going to report heart rate to somebody who's interested, how do they want to hear that number? Beats per minute, right? Beats per minute is your heart rate. And you could do that just by palpating your radial artery right here or carotid artery or whatever and figure out what your heart rate is. And that is controlled by the pacemaker potential slope at the SA node. All right, so we were talking about that last time. All right, and we talked about this table 14.1. And the interesting thing about this table shows us that the parasympathetic nervous system only changes the rate of the heart, not the force of contraction, because there is no vagus nerve going to the atrial muscle or ventricular muscle. So that's a little strange, right? Because usually we rely on antagonism to provide precise control and balance, but that's not in effect here in terms of the inotropic effects on the heart. And when I say inotropic effect, what kind of effect is that? That's force of contraction. That's right. So the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system are antagonistic in terms of chronotropic effects, but not in terms of inotropic effects, because only the sympathetic nervous system goes to the ventricular muscle and atrial muscle. And when it releases norepinephrine, what's the effect on the ventricle and the atria? Increased force of contraction, right? All right, and so that's what we see right here. So that's kind of an interesting system. All right, so let's talk about stroke volume. How would you calculate stroke volume? I didn't put that on the test, but maybe next time I will, because it's a really nice parameter to be familiar with. How would you calculate stroke volume? Yeah, end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. That's the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats, and we calculated it one time. All right, so stroke volume is really important for maintaining blood pressure and blood flow through your body. It's determined by three important variables. The first one is the end diastolic volume, which is what? The volume of blood at the end of diastole. So what is the heart doing at that time? Is it small or is it dilated? It's dilated. At the end of diastole, the heart is filled with blood. And so the stroke volume kind of relates to, it's how much blood is pumped out of the heart. And the stroke volume changes with end diastolic volume because as the heart stretches, use a model to think of skeletal muscle. How does the force generated by skeletal muscle change as you stretch it? Does it change at all? Or does it remain constant? Okay, it changes, right? Because remember, if a sarcomere is shortened to maximum, right, there is good overlap between the myosin and actin filaments, but there's no room for the Z-discs to get any closer together because the sarcomere is so short. So as we stretch a sarcomere, it can contract with more force because why? Because the myosin and actin filaments can slide over each other and generate tension. All right, so we actually call that the Frank Starling law of the heart. I'll talk about that again for sure. All right, so end diastolic volume is very, very important. The total peripheral resistance is the impedance to blood flow out of the ventricles. As the resistance increases, right, stroke volume decreases. And then also just the myocardial contractility of the heart, the strength of ventricular contraction. So all of these things right here affect stroke volume. So in order to regulate stroke volume, those are some variables that your body can adjust. All right, the end diastolic volume, sometimes we call that the preload on the heart. All right, so that's the workload on the heart prior to contraction. Stroke volume is directly proportional to preload, all right, and to contraction. The strength of contraction varies directly with the end diastolic volume. And always think of overlap of actin and myosin filaments to help explain that. Okay, the total peripheral resistance, which is what we call the afterload, impedes the ejection from the ventricle. Right, that's also going to regulate stroke volume, so as the resistance increases, less blood can actually be pumped out of the heart. Right, and we measure this by thinking of something we call the ejection fraction. And you're familiar with these terms right here, stroke volume and end diastolic volume. We can calculate as a percentage the amount of blood that's pumped out of the ventricle every time it contracts. All right, so let me put some analogy on the board. Here, I thought of an analogy right before class. Let me see if I can remember it. On the test, how many questions were there? Total questions. You had 100 questions, right? Okay, and let's just say that these total questions, right, we're going to consider this to be the end diastolic volume, okay, and we're going to say the number right that you got on the test. All right, let's say you got 90 questions correct on the test. How would you calculate your percentage? It would be the number right that you got divided by what, the total number of questions. All right, so what's that equal to? 90/100, and that would be 90%. All right, so you have a feel for that, how you would calculate somebody's percentage on a test. All right, another way of thinking of this, all right, let's put stroke volume and then diastolic volume in here. So stroke volume would be like the amount right that the heart got on a test. That's the amount of blood that the heart is pumping out. All right, so let's just say that it's pumping out 90 milliliters. And what is the total volume of the heart? That would be the end diastolic volume. Let's just say it's 100 mLs. So then what would be the ejection fraction? ejection fraction is equal to what? Stroke volume divided by end diastolic volume, which is equal to this, which is 90%. Right? So the stroke the ejection fraction is just the percentage of the blood that's pumped out of the ventricle as a percentage of the total volume every time it beats. All right, so that's what the ejection fraction is. And that's a very important clinical tool. Right? Normally it's about 60%, not 90%, which means how much blood is left in the ventricle compared to end diastolic volume. 40% is left in there. That's right, only 60% is ejected. Right? 40% is left over. And as a heart begins to fail, right, due to a number, could be due to any kind of reason, right, this ejection fraction decreases and decreases and decreases and can be used to time surgery. For instance, if a valve has to be replaced or something. And then after a certain point, there's pretty much nothing we can do for a heart because it's so stretched out, all the sarcomeres are so damaged, there's really nothing we can do to repair that heart. And what would a patient need if their ejection fraction is so low it passes that threshold to where we can restore function to the heart? What does a patient need then? Then they need a heart transplant because there's nothing that can be done to that heart to bring it back. Yeah.
Is that where the
cardiac
monitor?
Oh, you know, I don't have a picture of a cardiac monitor in my mind, what it looks like. For a cardiac monitor, could they get at ejection fraction? You know, I think you need at least ultrasound to do that. So probably not. Okay, probably not. You need some kind of imaging modality.
Echocardiogram.
Okay. Electrocardiogram, I don't even know if they could get... Echocardiogram, yeah. Echocardiogram. You need ultrasound or an echocardiogram to do that. Okay, you need to do some kind of imaging to look. There might be some ways under certain circumstances to correlate it with ECG or other kinds of parameters, but those are really indirect measures and probably not really good enough if you're trying to, like, save somebody's life, for instance. Okay, echocardiogram or ultrasound. So ejection fraction is pretty important. Okay, well, for some reason, I remember talking about this, Frank Starling law of the heart. Okay, maybe it was in the last chapter, but in your notes, what you should write down is that there are two general ways that the heart is controlled. All right, so I'm going to erase this. The first way is what we call intrinsic mechanisms. All right, and the second way is through extrinsic mechanisms. And the Frank Starling law of the heart is an example of an intrinsic mechanism, which means that it's a mechanism that's a result of just the heart all by itself. The way the heart is put together, the way it's built, right, determines how it functions. And it doesn't need innervation to affect the heart. It's just intrinsic to the heart. It's just a property of the heart all by itself. And that is the Frank Starling law. Right, it states that the strength of ventricular contraction varies directly with end diastolic volume. So when we say directly varies, what does that mean? If it varies directly, what are we looking at? Strength, well, let's just say contractility. Strength of contraction. Contractility, the strength of contraction is going to be equal to something if it's directly related. What does that mean? Let's just say that we have put a fraction right here. If it's directly related, where does that parameter end diastolic volume go? Does it go in the numerator or the denominator? It goes in the numerator. End diastolic volume. Right? So if end diastolic volume goes up, right, what happens to contractility? It has to increase as well. If end diastolic volume goes down, contractility has to go down. That's the relationship when we say it's directly related to something. Okay, just due to that mathematical equation right there. So as the end diastolic volume increases, right, as we go from left to right on this plot, so here we have a plot of stroke volume, which is sort of like contractility, force of contraction on the heart, versus end diastolic volume as end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to stroke volume? Look at these curves right here. They are all increasing, right? So this shows the direct relationship between end-diastolic volume and stroke volume on the heart. Furthermore, we see three different curves right here, right? And this shows the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the ventricles of the heart. So as we increase sympathetic stimulation on the heart, what happens to stroke volume? Even at just one end-diastolic volume. So let's pick a end-diastolic volume right by this C, right above the C, right? And let's put a vertical line right here, all right? So if we go from this curve where there's no sympathetic stimulation, right, and let's not change the end-diastolic volume, let's keep it the same, but let's increase sympathetic stimulation, what happens to stroke volume? It increases. And let's apply a little bit more sympathetic stimulation. What, and we're keeping end-diastolic volume the same, what happens to stroke volume? It increases, right? So again, stroke volume is directly related to end-diastolic volume, but also what? Sympathetic stimulation on the heart. And that's an intrinsic property of the heart. All right, and the reason why that is, we can look at this plot right here that shows force of contraction versus time for a number of different conditions, ABCD. Right? And what these different conditions are is the amount of stretch of the heart muscle. And when we stretch a heart muscle, let's look at this sarcomere right here. So here we see a Z-disc and a Z-disc. And look, there's plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, so there's plenty of cross bridges that can form at condition A right here. But when this sarcomere is stimulated to contract by flooding it with calcium, for instance, and giving it ATP, can this sarcomere shorten anymore? It cannot, because the Z-discs are already bumping up against the myosin filaments, and it can't shorten anymore. Therefore, it can't produce any more tension. But as it's stretched out, right, notice there's still really nice overlap between actin and myosin. A lot of cross bridges can form, but now the sarcomere can shorten a little bit and produce a little bit of tension, which is necessary to eject blood out of the heart. All right, condition C, right? The sarcomere is stretched out some more, and even condition D, the sarcomere is stretched out even more, but we still have nice adequate overlap for cross bridges to form, and now the sarcomere can shorten a lot, and it will produce a lot of tension. And why does it need to produce tension? To eject blood out of the heart. So what would you do to the heart to stretch this sarcomere out? What do you do to the heart to get those sarcomeres stretched out? You increase the filling on the heart, the filling of the heart. What do we call filling of the heart? The end-diastolic volume, right? So as end-diastolic volume goes up, the heart stretches out, and what happens to the contractility of the heart then? It increases just because the heart is filling properly. And that, what kind of mechanism is that for controlling contractility of the heart? Is that intrinsic or extrinsic? Intrinsic, because the sarcomere is what? Just a part of the heart itself. All right, so that's really beneficial. The heart, and normal hearts like what we have, it can adjust how it contracts just by how much blood is being given to it during diastole, which is really fantastic in most cases. All right, so let's look at extrinsic control. Extrinsic means that the control is going to be exerted from something from outside the heart, not a property or the structure of the heart itself, but from outside the heart. So give me an example of an organ that lies outside the heart. Your brain, for instance, right? Your brain can affect contractility of the heart via the autonomic nervous system, okay? Through the medulla, because the cardioregulatory center is in the adrenal medulla. So here we have a plot of relative tension, right, versus length of muscle as a percent of its optimum at 100%. And we have these two curves, which are cardiac muscle as compared to skeletal muscle, just to contrast with skeletal muscle. But we're mostly interested with this cardiac muscle right here. And we can see that as the length of the muscle increases along this axis right here, What else could we label this axis with? Instead of saying length of muscle, right, or length of a sarcomere, you could just as well say what? What changes the length of a sarcomere in a heart? The end diastolic volume. So you might actually want to pencil in, like, for instance, end diastolic volume on this horizontal axis right here. All right. So what happens to the tension that's developed, or contractility of the heart? As the end diastolic volume increases, what happens to contractility? It increases as well. All right. So these are what we call the ascending limbs on that Frank-Starling curve. All right. But now let's layer in the effects of epinephrine. Who can tell me where epinephrine comes from? Okay. It's a agonist of the sympathetic nervous system, which means that it's a hormone of the sympathetic nervous system, and it comes from the adrenal medulla gland, right? Because there are preganglionic sympathetic nerve fibers that go directly to the adrenal medulla, and when they stimulate the adrenal medulla, it releases epinephrine into the blood, about 80%, 20% norepinephrine, and that epinephrine then goes everywhere in the body via the circulatory system, including the heart. Okay, and it shifts the Frank-Starling curve to the left. So at the same end diastolic volume, right, without epinephrine, we see it produces very little tension, but with epinephrine, it produces a lot more tension. All right, but this is due to what? Sympathoadrenal activity. And so this is coming from the adrenal medulla, so it's an extrinsic mechanism for controlling the heart. All right, so norepinephrine and epinephrine produce both an increase in heart rate. What effect do we call that? If there's an increase in heart rate, what kind of effect do we call that in a little bit more sophisticated terminology? It's a chronotropic effect, right? Heart rate has to do with time. Chronograph is a time instrument. And would you say positive chronotropic effect or negative chronotropic effect? If it speeds it up, it's a positive chronotropic effect. All right, but norepi and epi also are positive inotropic agents, which means what? It increases force of contraction when the muscle contracts as well. All right, and that effect is due to increased calcium in sarcomeres after epinephrine and norepinephrine bind to receptors in the heart. And maybe you should know something about those receptors. Like, what kind of receptor was that? Ooh, that wasn't on last test. That was on the test before. Yeah, beta-1 receptors, right? Beta-1 adrenergic receptors. Okay, increase. They're both increased force and rate of contraction in cardiac muscle. All right, so we kind of looked at this a couple times before, and that is cardiac output. All right, so let's see. What are the dimensions of cardiac output? It's flow. Cardiac output is flow. How would you measure cardiac output or flow? All right. How would you measure something in here? Oh, yeah, I don't have a sign-in sheet. Pass one around. Thank you. How do you measure anything? Do you need like some kind of ruler to measure, right? If you're going to measure distance, all right, you just get a ruler and measure the distance in inches or feet or miles or something. But what are the dimensions of cardiac output? We put this on the board. It's a volume per time. It's a volume of fluid per time. How do we measure volume in science? Like milliliters or liters, for instance. But in the heart, we don't talk about it in liters because that's too big a volume. It's milliliters, right? Milliliters per minute would be a good measurement of cardiac output. All right, maybe I'll have to do this again. Cardiac output. Cardiac output, CO, is equal to milliliters per minute. And how can we calculate that? What do we know per minute? What can we measure on the heart per minute? That's easy. Heart rate. All right, so what's heart rate? HR is equal to what? Beats. Beats per minute. And we're going to multiply that number by something that we can't measure in class right here, would be the stroke volume. And what's the stroke volume? That's just the volume of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it does what? Every time it beats, right? So volume would be milliliters every time it beats. That's milliliters per beat. And if you look at these dimensions right here, what happens to this beat and this beat? They cancel each other out, and what are you left over with? Milliliters per minute. So this is, all right, this is a flow. And it's sort of a measure of contractility of the heart, cardiac output. So what are some things that affect the cardiac output? Well, why are we interested in cardiac output? Because it's going to help determine blood pressure in your body, and it's going to determine if blood will flow to your heart or to your brain, delivering oxygen, right, to keep all these organs alive. So how can we talk about cardiac output in terms of being directly related or inversely related to these two parameters, heart rate and stroke volume? What would you say? Directly related or inversely related? Okay. If heart rate increases and stroke volume stays the same, what happens to cardiac output? It increases. So heart rate is directly related to cardiac output. What about if heart rate stays the same, but you increase the stroke volume? What happens to cardiac output? It increases. So both heart rate and stroke volume are directly related to cardiac output. That also means that if heart rate goes down, cardiac output goes down. If stroke volume goes down, cardiac output goes down. That's what it means by being directly related. Okay, so let's look at some of these other variables right here. All right, sympathetic nerves. What's the effect on cardiac rate? Increases heart rate. What's going to happen to cardiac output? Will increase because it's what? Directly related. Sympathetic nerves also increase contraction, strength of contraction, which then increases stroke volume. What's going to happen to cardiac output? It increases, right? And so, because it's directly related, so sympathetic nerves, since it increases both the rate and the stroke volume, that markedly increases cardiac output, right? It's like a double whammy effect right here. All right, the parasympathetic nervous system. Where do the parasympathetic nerves go to? Do they go to the muscle or just to the nodal tissue? Just the nodal tissue. So parasympathetic nerves can only affect a heart rate, has no effect on stroke volume. All right, but the parasympathetic nervous system does what to cardiac rate? Decreases, therefore it's going to decrease cardiac output. All right, but that's the only effect that we see. All right, there's some other things, like the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. Oh, I tell you what, this right here is what kind of property of the heart, for what kind of mechanism? Intrinsic and sympathetic and parasympathetic are extrinsic control. All right, so because of the Frank Starling Law of the Heart, right, as end-diastolic volume increases, what can you tell me about stroke volume? It increases as well, because it increases through stretch. Right, it increases force of contraction. Right, I don't know why it has this two-pronged effect right here. They're kind of similar. Okay. So let's talk about another parameter, and it's going to be related to end diastolic volume, and that is venous return. Venous return is just the amount of blood that's returned to the heart via all the veins that are coming back from the systemic circulation. Right, and venous return controls the end diastolic volume. Right, as the heart, as more blood is flowing back from the veins into the heart, what happens to the heart? Just actually think of a nice structural picture in your mind. What happens to the heart as it fills up with blood? It dilates, right? It stretches out, and as it stretches out because of that intrinsic property of the heart, what happens to stroke volume? It increases. And since stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? Because why? Because cardiac output and stroke volume are directly related. That's how we would talk about that, right? Okay. All right, so let's look and see what venous return is dependent on. Some other things control venous return: blood volume and venous pressure. All right, so if your blood volume decreases, the pressure, your blood pressure decreases as well. All right, a nice easy way to think of this is maybe after class you walk out to the parking lot and you notice that one of your tires on your car is kind of low in pressure. It's kind of flat, not completely flat, but sort of flat. All right, so you're going to stop at the gas station on the way home, and what are you going to do, okay, to get the pressure in that tire back to where it should be? Should you take air out or should you put air in? You got to put air in there, right, to get the pressure up. Okay. All right, so as blood volume increases, all right, then the pressure increases. That's going to increase venous return. That's going to increase end-diastolic volume. And, of course, that's going to increase stroke volume and cardiac output when that happens. All right, vasoconstriction of veins, all right, by increasing sympathetic tone. A good way to think of this is think of a balloon that's got water in it, okay? Vasoconstriction would be what? Pressing on the balloon or trying to pull, expand the balloon by pulling on it. Vasoconstriction would be like grabbing it and pressing it. All right, so if you grab a water balloon and press on it really, really, really hard, all right, what happens to the pressure inside the balloon? Does it go up or down? It goes up. As a matter of fact, you probably wouldn't do that because if you press hard enough, what's going to happen? The pressure goes up so high that the balloon is going to pop right there in front of your face, right? So that's going to increase, right, the pressure, which is going to cause an increased venous return, which is going to increase end-diastolic volume, which will then increase stroke volume and cardiac output. All right, how else can we increase venous return? Okay, and we talked about this, I think, in the last chapter. How do we get blood going back to our heart, especially from our extremities? By contracting skeletal muscle, by pressurizing those veins in our extremities. And so the blood is going to flow from that area that's being pressurized to an area of lower pressure, but there's only one way it can go, right? If you contract your thigh muscles, blood will be pressurized there. It will have a tendency to squirt down toward your foot and also back up toward your heart, but it's only going to go one way. Why is that? Because there are valves and veins. That's right. As long as those valves are healthy, that's what's going to happen. All right, and I hope we all have healthy valves in our veins, because that's a mess if you don't have healthy valves there. Okay, we call that the skeletal muscle pump. And, of course, the one other reason would be by changing intrathoracic pressure. All right, so as we expand our rib cage, the pressure in our thorax decreases, so air flows into our lungs. But what else will flow into our thoracic cavity as we expand our rib cage? Blood will get sucked into our thoracic cavity as well toward our heart. Okay, so we call that the respiratory pump. Okay, so venous return is going to affect end-diastolic volume. If you increase venous return, you increase end-diastolic volume, and what's going to happen to contractility or cardiac output? It will increase as well. All right, so let's look at some effects for venous return. Blood volume. Blood volume can be influenced by urine volume. All right, so as we urinate, what happens to blood volume? As we lose fluid from our body, our blood volume decreases, right? That's going to decrease venous return. That's going to decrease end-diastolic volume. The heart will get weaker. Blood pressure will go down. All right, so if your body needs to maintain blood pressure, a good way to do that would be to decrease urine formation, to keep fluids inside your body. That will increase blood volume, increase venous return, and then increase contractility because the end-diastolic volume increases, all right? And tissue fluid volume participates in blood volume depending on how much urine is produced. Okay, we talked about breathing. Venous pressure via venoconstriction from sympathetic nerves and the skeletal muscle pump right here increase venous return. That increases diastolic volume, increases cardiac output. We kind of talked about that already. I don't know if this is an exam figure, but it's probably a good idea if you have a little bit of a feeling for how this works. Okay, veins hold most of the blood in the body, almost 70%. Therefore, we call these capacitance blood vessels. They have really thin walls. They stretch really easy as a result of that. All right, so these vessels right here, right, depending on the state of constriction, can change your blood volume dramatically and can dramatically change your blood pressure depending on the needs of your body. Okay, so that's really the importance of this slide right here. All right, so let's talk about some ways that your body adjusts blood volume. And why is blood volume important? Because blood volume affects venous return to the heart. And what does that affect? End diastolic volume, which affects what? The contractility of the heart itself. So it's very important to control blood volume, because when you adjust blood volume, you're controlling the contractility of your heart, of the heart itself. Okay. So blood volume and thus blood pressure is controlled by three hormones in your body: antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone, and atrionatriuretic hormone. And what I want you to be able to answer sometime, maybe after this lecture or the next one, is which of these above hormones are synergistic to each other and which are antagonistic to each other. And what would you automatically expect? That they should all be synergistic? Or should some be antagonistic to each other? There should be some antagonism there, because what does that provide you? Precise control and balance over your blood pressure. Okay, so we're going to take a look at this. So, antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? Yeah, makes you pee, makes you lose volume, fluid volume. What does antidiuretic mean? It makes you retain fluid, right? Makes you retain fluid. All right, and as you retain fluid, what happens to your blood pressure? It actually increases, because venous return increases. Okay, well, let's take a look at some of these slides that you have in your book. Antidiuretic hormone is also called vasopressin. And I think we talked about ADH in the endocrine chapter, so you kind of know where it comes from, namely the posterior pituitary. And the posterior pituitary is connected to a part of your brain. What's the part of your brain that the pituitary is directly connected to? The hypothalamus. That's right. So there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus that detect high osmolality, which is what? High salt. So the hypothalamus measures how much salt is in the fluids of your body. All right, so ADH is released when there's excess salt in your body, and that could be due to what? Two possible causes. Maybe too many margaritas, right? Too much salt intake. You build up salt in your body. Or if you lose water, maybe you're exercising and you're perspiring, or you're out hiking in the Grand Canyon and you lose a lot of water to cool your body down, what happens to the salt concentration in your body? As you lose water, your salt concentration goes up, right? You're not changing the amount of salt, it's just the concentration of it goes up. All right, and there are receptors that monitor that, which are called osmoreceptors, and they're located in the hypothalamus, all right, and when they detect high salt or dehydration, it will give you the sense of thirst. You'll be thirsty when that happens. All right, the osmoreceptors will stimulate water reabsorption from urine. We haven't talked about urine formation yet, but you know, we'll get to that sooner or later. Your kidneys can produce urine that's very dilute with a lot of water in it, all right, and it will be a lot of volume, high volume, a lot of water, and dilute meaning hardly any salt. Or if your body is low on water, the kidneys will produce urine that's very concentrated and a small volume, very, very small volume of water with a lot of salt in it. Okay, so ADH will stimulate water resorption from urine, which means that your urine output will go way down, and as a result, it will become very salty, right? And that water then stays in your body, right? So that's what we mean by water resorption, is when you retain water in your body, right? So ADH release is inhibited by low osmolality. So you see that it works in both ways. So here probably is an exam figure that you should be able to, right, just draw out to get in the flow of the thought right here. All right, so this is a response loop. And what does a response loop always start with? A stimulus. So here is the stimulus. Dehydration, which is going to produce a decreased blood volume. All right, and you might be worried about this because as your blood volume decreases, how's that going to affect your cardiovascular system when you start to lose blood volume? Right? When you lose blood volume, venous return decreases to the heart, and diastolic volume goes down. What happens to the strength of the heart when that happens? It gets weaker. All right? And none of us really want to have weak hearts. So this could be a really serious circumstance, right? So the stimulation decreases blood volume due to dehydration or maybe too much salt. Right? That increases blood osmolality. And blood osmolality is measured by osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. So it's the job of the hypothalamus to integrate all that information up and compare it to what? What the normal osmolality of your body should be. What do we call that? What's a general name of that? The normal value. That's called? That was on your test one time or two before. What do we call that? Normal value. And where is it contained? That normal value is called the set point. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a set point. So all that stuff that we learned before, that we're going to start to apply it now. All right, so that's called the set point. Where's the set point located? Integration center. So what's the name of the integration center? Is going to be the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus integrates all that information together, compares it to the set point, makes a decision, and if the information is dehydration or excessive salt ingestion, what's the decision? It's going to increase antidiuretic hormone. It's going to also give you the sense of thirst. All right, so what effect is that going to have on the body? Well, ADH comes from the posterior pituitary, so posterior pituitary is going to increase ADH, antidiuretic hormone. So what happens to urine formation as ADH increases? Urine volume decreases, which then means you retain fluid in your body. So we say what? Water retention in the kidneys increases, right? And when you're thirsty, hopefully you have some water available to you, right? And what's the effect of keeping water in your body and drinking water at the same time? Your water volume goes up inside your body, so blood volume increases, blood osmolality decreases, and how does this compare to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract? Okay, blood volume increases. What was it for the stimulus? Decreases. The arrow is opposite, right? So it subtracts from the stimulus. So what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop, which does what typically? It maintains homeostasis, right? So hopefully you were thinking of some of those things, okay? So negative feedback maintains a nice compensated disease-free state in the body. So this is a nice scheme for maintaining blood volume. What happens if you drink soda, like diet soda or regular soda? Okay. Well, that will help you. That will certainly help you. And as long as you're not a diabetic or something, then that sugar, if you're exercising, is great. You know, that will keep you going.
Doesn't that make you more dehydrated, though?
Well, there are some drinks that have sugar in them and other electrolytes that are isoosmotic in the body. Okay, and in that case, it's not going to hurt you. But for instance, if you drink, like soda pop, you were saying,
yeah,
that is really high in glucose. Right, so it's highly concentrated with solutes, and that actually could dehydrate you because you're actually like drinking salt water. Okay. So the best, when you're thirsty, the best thing to drink would be water, okay? But then again, you can't overdo that either, right? You can overdose on water. It's really hard to do it. You have to put your mind to it. There's a couple of circumstances where it happens normally or abnormally. I don't know, maybe I'll think of a time to talk about that sometime. Okay. And what kind of people would be the most susceptible to radical changes in osmolality? It's going to radically change their electrolytes and their blood pressure. I don't know if I can figure out how to ask this question properly. Well, there are certain people where drinking the right solution of something is very important, because this positive feedback system, right, or this negative feedback system, hasn't developed yet. That's a clue. Infants in particular, right? So infants, when they're losing fluid from their body, maybe due to vomiting or diarrhea or whatever, which is what, a very common circumstance, the kinds of fluids that you should give them are what? Isotonic fluids, like Pedialyte and things like that, that have just the right level of salts and sugars in there so that it doesn't dehydrate them or overhydrate them. Yeah. And if you're really worried about yourself, Pedialyte is great for you too. Okay? Yeah. Because, all right, when you're presented with some kind of traumatic experience, one way that our bodies sometimes compensate, especially if you break a bone and you hemorrhage, right, so if you lose blood from your body, what happens to venous return? All right, so if you hemorrhage, you lose blood volume, venous return decreases to the heart, all right, and or if you become dehydrated, your blood pressure is going to decrease. And, so blood volume is going to decrease. That's going to trigger, this thirst response right here. And so when you get thirsty, you'll have a tendency to drink, and that will boost your blood pressure back up. So it's related to blood pressure. So when you get injured, your blood pressure goes back down. One way that your body knows how to get blood pressure back up to where it should be is through the sensation of thirst. All right, so that's one thing. But I don't know if I've really experienced that, if that's true or not. Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Like really, really thirsty?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
really? Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Well, that kind of goes along with nowadays, EMTs can, on the way to the hospital, what can they hook up to you? They can hook up an IV with saline, all right? And so that fluid then goes into your cardiovascular system. What happens to your blood volume? You don't have any more red blood cells, but what happens to your blood volume? It goes up, venous return goes up, and diastolic volume goes up. What happens to the heart? The strength of heart contraction is maintained just by hooking up that IV with saline. And that will help maintain somebody's blood pressure. Okay, so it's related to blood pressure. All right, so ADH is the first hormone that we're talking about. And what's the effect of increased ADH? Is going to be increased blood volume, right? It's going to increase blood pressure because of the direct relationship with end-diastolic volume and contractility on the heart. All right. Aldosterone. I think we're kind of familiar with aldosterone. We looked at where it was produced. You probably don't have to know the exact layer of the adrenal cortex that produces aldosterone, but this is what we call a mineralocorticoid, because it comes from the adrenal cortex. Oh, I was going to ask you that right here. Okay, but don't forget it's a steroid hormone. When we look into the mechanism a little bit later of aldosterone, right, it's a steroid hormone. So where's the receptor for? It's going to be inside the cell someplace, right? It's not on the plasma membrane, because it can actually enter cells, right? It helps maintain blood volume, and if it maintains blood volume, it's going to also maintain blood pressure, right? Because they're related to each other, right? And it does that through reabsorption and retention of salt and water in the urine. So guess where it works? On the kidney, right? Okay. Aldosterone is stimulated by salt deprivation, low blood volume, and low blood pressure. And what's the organ that secretes aldosterone? What would you want to fill in right here? Adrenal cortex. Right? So the adrenal cortex is important for controlling blood pressure, blood volume, which means it's going to help control the function of the heart as well. All right, so how does this happen? It happens through the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism or system. And a lot of times in class, I just say the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system because it has a number of steps in it. And students dread learning about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. But I think if you look at it probably five times, right, it will become a really nice friend for you. All right, so make sure you study it a lot over the weekend. All right, so let's talk about it. When there is a salt deficit, low blood volume or low blood pressure, angiotensin 2 is produced. All right, angiotensin 2 produces a number of effects in the body, all aimed at increasing blood pressure. So angiotensin 2 can cause vasoconstriction, including veins. What happens when veins vasoconstrict? Increases venous return, right? And that helps what? Boost blood pressure. Okay, angiotensin 2 causes the release of aldosterone. What does aldosterone do again? Maybe let's go back. All right, it increases blood pressure, right? It has the opposite effect, right? Because it's going to work through, it says right here, helps maintain blood volume and pressure. So it's going to help maintain blood pressure. All right, and thirst. Angiotensin 2 gives you the sensation of thirst. What's going to be the effect of blood pressure when you drink something? It's going to increase your blood pressure, right? Just like hooking up an IV. It's going to increase fluid volume in your body. All right, so how do we get to angiotensin 2? Here is a nice response loop that for sure is an exam figure. I was going to say is for sure on your next exam. Well, I can't remember if it is or not. But let's look at this statement right here first before we get into the workings of it. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, otherwise known as what? The dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. So this thing right here is the most important thing for regulating blood pressure in people. And what can you tell me about blood pressure? Does everybody have great blood pressure? Or do some people have pathological, diseased blood pressure? A lot of people have it. What do we call it? Hypertension. Hypertension is above normal blood pressure. Some people even have hypotension, which is below normal. That's not really so important as hypertension. And as a matter of fact, the lower your blood pressure is, the better in terms of developing cardiovascular disease. So the lower your blood pressure is, the better, as long as you have enough blood pressure to undergo all your daily activities. For instance, if your blood pressure is so low, when you go from a sitting down position to standing up that you pass out, is that good? No, that's not good, right? Because then you hit your head on the table and then the chair and then it bounces on the floor a couple times, right? So that's not good. All right, but high blood pressure is deadly. It will kill you. So let's look at this mechanism right here because we treat, you know, just millions of people according to this mechanism. So let's look and see how it works. This is a response loop, which always starts with a stimulus and it ends with a response down over here. Okay, so the stimulus is, let's just say, a decreased blood pressure. All right, and as blood pressure decreases, there's going to be less blood flow to the kidneys. So the kidneys do a lot more than just produce urine. All right, the kidneys can monitor blood pressure. And in particular, it's the juxtaglomerular apparatus of the kidney. And where that is in the kidney, it's actually part of the nephron. It's where the efferent and afferent arteriole enter or leave the glomerulus, and the distal convoluted tubule goes right between them. That's the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And if you need to pop open your anatomy book to kind of look at that to refresh your memory, that probably would be good, so it's not so foreign. All right, that's the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, when there's low blood pressure, this apparatus releases renin, all right, into the blood. And renin is not a hormone, it's an enzyme. So what does an enzyme do? Speeds up the rate of a reaction, right? So it promotes a chemical reaction. And it takes angiotensinogen. And what can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's a big long word, but it's what? It's inactive. But what is it ready to do? Go to work at a moment's notice. And renin is the notifier, right? It will convert angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1, right, in your blood. So now you got angiotensin 1 floating around in your body. It doesn't have a lot of power to change the physiology of your body. It has to be converted into something else, which is called angiotensin 2. And there is an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme that converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And ACE, so we just call that ACE, is located in a couple organs in your body, but mostly it's in your lungs, of all places. All right, so ACE is in your lungs, converts that into angiotensin 2. Now, angiotensin 2 has a lot of power to change things in your body. It's a hormone, and it's in the blood, so where does it go? All over the place. And in particular, it goes to the adrenal cortex, where there are receptors for angiotensin 2, right? And when angiotensin 2 binds to those receptors, it stimulates the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone. And aldosterone then does what? Causes salt and water retention by the kidneys. And as you retain salt and water, what happens to blood volume? It increases. And how does that correspond to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it. So this is what? A really nice negative feedback loop that involves renin, angiotensin, and aldosterone, and therefore we call that the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Yeah. Angiotensinogen, I think, mostly comes from the liver. I could be wrong about that, but I think the liver adjusts the levels of angiotensinogen. Okay. But I might have to look that up to make sure I'm correct on that. Okay. All right, angiotensin 2 also has another effect, vasoconstriction of arterioles. And we're going to look and see how that affects blood pressure to give you an intuitive feel for it. But for right now, we're going to say that increases blood pressure. Vasoconstriction of arterioles increases blood pressure, which again does what to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it. So that's another nice negative feedback loop that's going to maintain blood pressure at the proper level. Because as blood pressure increases, then the amount of renin is going to be scaled back, right? So that helps maintain proper blood pressure. Well, for some reason, and a lot of people, we're not exactly sure why it happens, but this mechanism is misbehaving, and too much water and salt is retained in the body. There's too much vasoconstriction of arterioles, and people usually have, right, too high a blood pressure. We call that hypertension. So how can we pharmacologically, right, change this mechanism right here to help somebody with hypertension? Okay, so here are a number of things. Well, you can prescribe, right, or the first line would be a diuretic. And somebody takes a diuretic, what happens to their blood volume? Blood volume decreases. And then what happens to blood pressure as a result? It decreases. All right, but remember, the body has a set point and says, well, if you're decreasing blood volume, let's just secrete more renin to overcome it. So a lot of times when people have hypertension, they can't just take one therapy because their body is going to naturally compensate for it and produce hypertension through some other kind of mechanism. So when somebody has hypertension, they usually have to be on maybe two or even three kinds of medications to cover all of these different mechanisms that we're looking at. Okay, so here we have this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. When it's stimulated, right, it's going to increase blood pressure. All right, so we can interrupt this by interrupting this step right here, the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. Somehow interfere with angiotensin converting enzyme. And maybe you've heard of ACE inhibitors. Right, so an ACE inhibitor is going to blunt the effects of this step right here, and that's going to help lower somebody's blood pressure. So that's another thing that we can do. All right, a newer drug, ARBs, angiotensin 2 receptor blockers, that work where? In arterioles and also in the adrenal cortex. That's going to block the effect of angiotensin 2, which is what? Similar to an ACE inhibitor, but it's in a different step of this mechanism. All right. beta blockers, in particular, beta blockers. What's the beta receptor on the heart? Beta 1. And what's the effect on the heart going to be? Well, if a beta 1 is stimulated, what's the effect on the heart? Increase heart rate, increase force of contraction. That will increase cardiac output. That will increase blood pressure. So if we block those beta receptors, the heart will get weaker. It will slow down. Blood pressure will decrease as a result of that as well. Okay, but of course you can't give beta blockers for somebody that has hypotension. Because why? You'll knock them out, right? Their blood pressure will be so low that maybe they can't even maintain consciousness. All right, other kinds of things would be calcium channel blockers. Why would that be important? What's calcium important for? Contractility of the heart, right? So if you block calcium channels in the heart, calcium can't get into the heart. It can't contract with the same kind of vigor, which means your blood pressure will go down. Okay, and then there's some very powerful things that will dilate blood vessels. These are the alpha-2 agonists. These are really, really dramatic. So if somebody has really high blood pressure, that has to be controlled immediately, because if your blood pressure gets so high, what could happen? Think of that water balloon. Your blood pressure can be so high that it's going to blow up blood vessels in your body. And of course that's bad, but if there's a blood vessel in your brain that blows up or your heart, then, right, that's very, very bad. So things, an alpha-2 agonist like clonidine can control somebody's blood pressure probably in just a matter of minutes. But most people probably would feel really bad, but at least they're alive. Okay. So here's a little website where you can look at some of these different, which I just have the action by, or some drugs by the action that they produce in the body. You can go to this website and actually look at various names. They probably have generic names and trade names of various drugs that do these kinds of things. Okay, so this is the renin-angiotensin mechanism. And why is this important? Because this is the most important mechanism for maintaining blood pressure in the long term. Not from second to second, but from day to day or week to week or even month to month. Okay? Okay. So make sure you can draw this one out, right? Because if you can draw this out on a blank piece of paper, then you're going to have a really fun time on the test if I give you the diagram and all you got to do is fill it in, right? Okay. And it's really good to have that picture in your mind, because you're going to be running into people all day long that have problems with this mechanism. And if you can think about it in this graph form, that's really powerful. All right, so we've talked about ADH, antidiuretic hormone. We've talked about aldosterone. And guess what? We got one more hormone to talk about, and that is atrial natriuretic hormone. Your book calls it peptide. That's fine with me. You could call it either one of those. Okay. And what is natrium? Why do we say natriuretic? What the heck does that mean? What is natrium? Sodium. Sodium, right? Na is the chemical symbol for sodium, and it comes from Greek natrium. So atrial natriuretic hormone. So it's going to have something to do with sodium, and it's also going to have something to do with what? Have you heard of an atrium? What's an atrium? That's a part of your heart. Okay. And that's kind of interesting, because blood pressure involves the heart a lot, but here's a hormone that involves the heart as well. All right, so expanded blood volume is detected by stretch. When your blood volume increases, what happens to your heart? Your end-diastolic volume increases, it starts to stretch, which is generally a really good thing because the heart gets stronger. All right, but the heart monitors that stretching all the time with stretch receptors, in particular in the left atrium. All right, and when the left atrium stretches out, or starts to stretch, it releases atrial natriuretic hormone when it stretches. Atrial natriuretic hormone inhibits aldosterone. So what's the mode of action? Is it synergistic or antagonistic to aldosterone? Antagonistic. Should you be worried? No, you should be happy, right? Antagonism, right, employed intelligently is a wonderful thing, right? Atrial natriuretic hormone promotes salt and water excretion to lower blood volume. All right, and natriuretic hormone also promotes vasodilation. So you should see a lot of opposite effects produced by atrial natriuretic hormone compared to ADH and aldosterone that we've looked at already. Maybe not in one lecture you can see that, but over the weekend when you go back and look at stuff, all right, maybe you'll start to see some nice themes right here. Okay. All right, so here is the feedback loop. All right, and it starts with increased blood volume. Right, and increased blood volume could be due to drinking a lot, for instance, drinking a lot of fluids. Right, increased blood volume is going to increase venous return to the heart. And as increased venous return happens, what happens to the state of the heart? It starts to stretch. It fills up with more blood, which is monitored by stretch receptors where? In the left atrium. And what's the effect going to be? The left atrium is going to secrete atrial natriuretic hormone into the blood. It's a hormone. And that hormone goes to the kidneys and it's going to increase urine volume, and in that urine there's going to be increased salt. So it not only causes excretion of water, but it's going to cause the excretion of salt. All right, so that's going into the urine. So that water and salt go into the urine right here. And where is it coming from? Okay? It's coming from the blood. So what happens to blood volume? As you lose that volume in urine, blood volume has to decrease. And what's the effect on venous return? It's going to decrease venous return. Right? So this is a nice negative feedback loop maintaining what? Blood pressure homeostasis as a result. Okay. These stretch receptors also send signals to the brain via the vagus nerve to the posterior pituitary, and it's going to cause a decrease in antidiuretic hormone, which again is going to decrease water reabsorption in the kidney, which means what? Water reabsorption increases blood fluids, but if reabsorption decreases, where does that fluid end up? In the urine. All right, so again, that produces urine, that increases urine volume, decreases blood volume, that feeds back negatively to the initial stimulus. So that this is a nice negative feedback system maintaining blood pressure homeostasis in the body. All right, so let's go back to this first question right here. Which of the above hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic to each other? All right, antidiuretic hormone. What's the effect on blood pressure for antidiuretic hormone? Increases blood pressure. What about aldosterone? Increases blood pressure. So what's the relationship between ADH and aldosterone? Synergistic or antagonistic? Synergists. Yeah, so these are synergists that maintain blood pressure. All right, now what about atrial natriuretic hormone? What's the effect on blood pressure? It decreases blood pressure. So AMP or ANH is what? Antagonistic to both aldosterone and ADH. All right, and because of these hormones, generally speaking, people have pretty well controlled blood pressure. But if that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism misbehaves, right, that's going to lead to hypertension. All right, so you got to look at those hormones over the weekend, and on Tuesday, if you got some questions, you got to make sure that you ask me about them. Okay? So, what's probably the most important thing for getting a good grade on a test? Do not procrastinate, right? So even though you just got done with a test, start looking at those response loops for ADH and aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone. Okay? And you have them in your book. All right, so I think I want to talk just a little bit about vascular resistance to blood flow. You've probably done a lab with this already. Okay, so you're a little familiar with it, but we probably need to build on some of these concepts. Let me just look at the next slide right here. Okay. Vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through an organ or a tissue. All right, and vasodilation, when a blood vessel dilates, that decreases resistance. And if you decrease resistance, what happens to blood flow? It increases, right? So vasodilation increases blood flow to an organ. The opposite effect happens as well. As you vasoconstrict, all right, what happens to blood flow? It decreases because resistance increases through that particular blood vessel. All right, so here is just a little table that shows blood flow through various organs in your body in terms of an absolute number right here, but this other column shows you as a percentage. All right, so notice your kidneys take a lot of blood flow. Almost 20% of all the blood flow through your body has to go through your kidneys. And if it doesn't get that blood flow, the kidneys die as a result. All right, so blood flow definitely has to be maintained through the kidneys just to keep them alive and also to provide the function that they give the body, like maintaining blood pressure, for instance, and excreting things that we don't need. The same thing for the brain, almost 20%, right? So those are highly metabolic organs that need a lot of blood flow. Okay. So how does flow happen? All right, what determines blood flow? How does a material flow from one place to another? And solids can't flow. But what can flow? Gases can flow from one place to another, or liquids can flow. So gases and liquids sometimes are what we call fluids. All right, so fluids flow from one place to another. And in your mind, you should think of a nice model, and that is, I've mentioned this before, how does diffusion work? Okay, now diffusion works when you can have like a solid particle, for instance a solute, move from one area to another. And how is it going to move from one area to another? According to a concentration gradient, right? And a solute will move from high concentration to low concentration, down its concentration gradient. Okay, well a fluid will flow due to not a concentration gradient, but you could almost think of it as a concentration gradient. It's a pressure gradient. And a pressure is just due to the number of molecules that are in that volume. So it's almost like concentration, right? It's kind of a nice model to have in your mind. If the pressure gradient goes to zero, well, what happens to flow from in these two areas? It will stop. Just like when a concentration gradient is zero, there won't be any diffusion of that solute from one place to another. So the flow rate is directly proportional to the pressure difference. All right, so if we got flow, it's going to be what? Equal to delta P. All right, so here we have, left ventricle. There should be a little V right here. Put a little V in your slide, right? Does that make sense? LA, LV. All right, so here we have blood in the LV coming around, going back to the RA. What does that remind you of? The systemic circulation, somebody said. That was exactly what I was thinking, right? So here we have nice systemic circulation. And the pressure, the mean pressure, is about 100 millimeters of mercury on the arteries over here. And it's about zero at the vena cava. So what's going to be the force that's forcing blood through the systemic circulation? That's delta P, which is what? 100 minus 0, or 100 millimeters of mercury. That's going to be the driving force for blood through the systemic circulation. And if the heart stops working, and so the mean pressure goes to 0, if it's 0 in the aorta, 0 in the vena cava, what happens to flow through the systemic circulation? It stops, right? Okay. How many seconds of consciousness do you have, just for fun? 3 seconds, right, when that happens. Right. And then what? 3 minutes and your brain dead. And remember, when a tissue's dead, it can't come back to life. All right, so flow is equal to, directly related to, the pressure difference from one end of a vessel to the other. But it's going to be inversely related to something we call resistance. All right, so flow rate is inversely proportional to resistance. So we got to put that in the denominator. So when I made this slide, I couldn't make a nice dividing sign like I did down over here. Right, so that if resistance increases, what happens to flow? It decreases. If resistance decreases, what happens to flow? It increases, right? That inversely means it goes the opposite way. As opposed to the pressure gradient, if the pressure gradient increases, what happens to flow? It increases because it's directly related. But if the pressure gradient decreases, flow decreases because it's directly related. All right, let me have a little drink. But we need to investigate a little bit more about what terms increase or decrease resistance in a blood vessel. And I think you did a lab. How long ago did you do this lab? Did you ever do it? I hope you did. Okay. Maybe a couple weeks ago. All right. And so resistance is directly proportional to the length of a blood vessel or any kind of vessel. You use glass rods or glass vessels, right? Pipes. So as the length of a vessel increases, what happens to resistance? It increases, right? Okay. And viscosity. I don't think you changed viscosity in your lab. Maybe you did. That'd be cool if you did. You could use a salt solution or something. But as fluid goes from water to, say, something like molasses, right, as the viscosity increases, what happens to flow? It decreases, right? Okay, so it's directly, resistance is directly proportional to the length and to viscosity, and that's the little Greek symbol that we use for viscosity. All right, I think that's called an eta. All right. Flow, or resistance, is, not flow, but resistance is inversely proportional to the radius. And it's not just the radius, it's the fourth power of the radius. This is actually a hugely important kind of term to remember. All right, so it's just not the radius, but it's the fourth power, which means what? Radius times the radius times the radius times the radius. All right, not just four times, but the fourth power. All right, it's a huge factor. All right, so the diameter of a blood vessel is very important for controlling resistance of a vessel, and because resistance is important for determining flow, the diameter of a blood vessel is hugely important for determining flow through a vessel because of this fourth power rule right here. All right, and so this law, right, was determined by Poiseuille. So it's Poiseuille's law. It describes the factors affecting blood flow, which is the first thing that affects blood flow in a direct relationship is what? The pressure gradient. As the pressure gradient increases, blood flow increases. All right, and then what is resistance? Resistance is eta L over radius to the fourth power. But when you put it in this equation, instead of having eta L over R to the fourth power, you can put the fourth power up in the numerator right here. So now you can see that blood flow is directly related to what parameters? So you can forget about resistance. Instead of thinking of resistance, think of radius, viscosity, and length. So blood flow is directly related to the pressure gradient, the radius of the blood vessel, right, and inversely related by viscosity and the length of a blood vessel. All right. So now what can you change in your body to regulate blood flow? Can you change the length of a blood vessel? Not very easily. Maybe over decades, right, from when you're 1 year old to 20 years old, the length of a blood vessel changes. But that's not a daily occurrence. So your body can't adjust blood flow by changing length. What about viscosity of blood? Does that change? Does your body change viscosity of your blood? It doesn't. Can't really control viscosity. Maybe I'll get back to that. Some athletes try to do that, and it's not very effective. All right. And so how does your body change blood flow? Can it change blood pressure? Yeah. By what mechanism? Ah, the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism and others that we're going to look at. And what about radius of a blood vessel? Can it change radius of a blood vessel? Sure, by controlling vasoconstriction or vasodilation, vasoconstriction via the sympathetic nervous system, right? So blood flow is controlled by blood pressure and vasoconstriction or vasodilation of blood vessels, according to Poiseuille's law right here. All right, so I know you want to keep going, but we got to stop. And we'll start here on Tuesday. Okay.